World War One on RTE.
At one point in 1917, over 1,000 horses were arriving in Britain each day from the United States to feed the war machine. The horses themselves had to be fed. The average ration of a supply horse was 20 pounds of fodder, which was a fifth less than recommended. This meant the average battalion needed at least 7,840 pounds of oats and hay a week to feed its 56 horses. Gun horses were bigger and pulled heavier loads, so required at least 30 pounds of daily fodder. They could spend up to 5 hours eating every day. Once in the field, if the animals escaped the artillery, they had to contend with disease, poison gas attacks, and succumbing to exhaustion. Some horses, having collapsed in ankle-deep mud, were too tired to lift their heads high enough to breathe and drowned in the wastes of the battlefield. In total, over 8 million horses died on all sides fighting in the war.
His name was Arthur Townsend. He was my grandfather's first cousin. His regiment was the Royal Kent. He first of all fought in the Boer War, and then he was in the First World War. Arthur Townsend kept a diary, and his last entry on the 15th of September 1916 was, "Going over the top tomorrow, may not survive." And he was in fact killed on the 16th. A comrade of his, when he was killed, went over to Arthur and he took the things out of his pocket, and amongst the things in his pocket were a couple of acorns. He brought them back and he planted them in UCC in Cork. And only this year, a gentleman from UCC contacted me to tell me that there was a huge oak tree there now, and that was always known as Townsend's Tree.
Well, there's only one word for it: bloody. You went into the line for 3 days and three nights, and at that time of the year, October, November, December, especially, the ditches, they weren't real trenches at all. The ditches were full of water and mud, and you came out caked in mud. Quite a lot of trench feet. You couldn't move at all, and there was nowhere to sleep. You'd get at the back of the parador and try and get a sleep there. But the German artillery was very, very active all the time, and of course their machine guns were a curse.
On the 17th of August 1915, my grandfather Joe Kennedy and his brothers Norman, Charlie and Frank signed what was called the Kennedy Family Compact. It was a family agreement whereby if any of the four brothers should be so unfortunate, as they put it, as to be disabled while fighting for his country in the Great European War of 1914, the remaining brothers would pledge themselves to assist the disabled one by every means in their power during his life or during such a period as he may be unfit for service. The following year, Charlie Kennedy signed up for service with the Royal Leinster Regiment. He was invalided out due to gas poisoning and was the only member of the family who suffered a war wound of any kind. The Kennedy Family Compact remains an intriguing document of how a family with a legal background saw their potential role in the First World War and how they saw the possibility that they would have to deal with the impairment or the wounding of a family member, and in a period where there might not be state pensions, look after the individuals in question should they be wounded.
Father Patrick Luby was one of the unsung heroes of the war. Not for him the accolades of those afforded Father Willie Doyle and others. He slipped between everyone's fingers. Patrick Luby was born in Caird, Tipperary, and educated at St John's Waterford and the Irish College in Paris. In 1915 he became chaplain and joined the 5th Norfolk Regiment. Patrick complained bitterly. "I'm not happy with this brigade, which is almost entirely Protestant. I'm disappointed as a young priest to have so little priest work to perform." He got his wish when he joined the 8th Battalion Northumberland Fusiliers, which had an Irish component, and went over the top in the Second Battle of Passchendaele on the 26th of October 1917. His senior reports, he was the first man killed, blown to pieces. No parts of his body were ever found. His father asked for remuneration and said, "I lost a great deal of money by this, son, and would be grateful for some remuneration." Father Patrick Luby, aged 28, left 7 shillings and 11 pence.
We went down with the rest of our friends to Lansdowne Road, and we all joined up and incidentally paid half a crown for the privilege of joining up. Oh, it was, we were all packed along there, and Colonel Downing, he was to be our commanding officer. He walked along and had a chat with each of us, and where we played and who and what and all about it. And then he said, well, are you willing to join up? And we said yes. So after that, we were told to run down to Brunswick Street, and we were all stripped there and run through. There wasn't much formality. You were weighed, measured, and given 3 and 6 pence your pay for the weekend, and told to go off and report to the Curragh on such a date.
The founder of the Women's Legion, Edith 7th Marchioness of Londonderry, visited the Western Front in April 1919. Although the fighting was over, her visit she recorded in a diary where she wrote, "It was to witness the result of a world become crazy. The spectacle could only have been conceived in the disordered brains of fiends and fools." She continued, "I felt incapable of expressing my feelings on finding myself for the first time in the visible presence on all sides of the barbarity of war. The desolation is complete as far as the eye can see. No words will describe adequately such a surfeit of ruins, such complete destruction. No one who was not there could imagine such a hell as it must have been during the fight." Leaving France, Edith's impression was the same as her first, and she wrote in her diary, "The feeling of death pervading everything, it appalled me and redoubled my admiration for the men who endured so much month after month to gain what in effect appeared so little at so high a price."
My dear mother and Pat, we went into the trenches again on Christmas Eve. It was a hard, cold and a clear night. About 7:30 p.m, the German lines were lit up by numerous lights, which turned out to be scores of candles on Christmas trees and all burning brightly. Following the appearance of the lights, the Germans began singing as loud as they could. We listened for a moment, and not a shot was fired by either side, and not even for many hours afterwards. The Germans were making happy the festival, and why not we too, thought some of the fellows in my trench. And there and then they started singing ragtime, and one or two Irish ones such as "Come Back to Erin." The more we sang, the more so did the Germans. Next morning, a couple of hours after daybreak, one of the Germans shouted across 4 times, "A Happy Christmas, English." I did not hear any of our chaps returning the compliment. I guess that's why he shouted 4 times.
If we believe Tom Barry's memoirs, he's very frank in his memoirs, and he says that in 1914, during the period of the outbreak of the First World War, he had no strong political convictions. He had not a great knowledge of the politics of the time. He didn't pay any attention to John Redmond. He went to the war simply to get a gun, to feel what it was like to be a man, to be involved in a war, for adventure. After the First World War, when Tom Barry came home, he then got involved in the IRA and probably was one of the most successful and effective combat leaders in the IRA during the War of Independence. Certainly his experience from the British military stood to him in the IRA. He had a great knowledge of tactics and training and organisation that you need to run a successful military unit.
An extract from the diary of the Reverend Robert H. Spence. From Friday, August the 6th, 1915, at the landing of Solver Bay in Gallipoli. Those of us tending the first wounded at the ambulance site had things horrible to see and sickening to deal with. When the last mines had exploded, stretcher and burial parties went out, still under sniper fire. The gathering up and the burying of the dead was a gruesome business, and the identification of each poor fellow even worse, terribly hard, if not impossible, to get right. Father Murphy and I shared the work, for no one knew, or could know, to what denomination the poor mutilated souls had once given their allegiance. Before the embarkation, Father Murphy had given general absolution to all the Munsters. While I had prayed with them, I just knew that it is character that counts at the gates of heaven, that and the mercy of God upon the souls of the men.
This is an extract from the diary of my great uncle, Edward Mannock, known as Mick Mannock, who was a First World War flying ace. 20th of July, 1917. Had the good fortune to bring a Hun two-seater down in our lines a few days ago. Luckily, my first few shots killed the pilot and wounded the observer, a captain, besides breaking his gun. The bus crashed south of Avion. I hurried out at the first opportunity and I gathered a few souvenirs, although the infantry had the first pick. The machine was completely smashed, and rather interesting also was the little black and tan terrier, dead, in the observer's seat. I felt exactly like a murderer. The journey to the trenches was rather nauseating, dead men's legs sticking through the sides with puttees and boots still on, bits of bones and skulls with the hair peeling off. This sort of thing, together with the strong graveyard stench and the dead and mangled body of the pilot, combined to upset me for a few days.
Business in Ireland boomed at the end of 1914. Large firms and industries all across the country were experiencing an incredible increase in trade. Trade was considered to be considerably higher than for the corresponding period in previous years, and all of the four principal Irish railway companies greatly increased their traffic. There was evidence too from motor car companies, where Thompson said, "We have almost more than we can do to deal with the great rush of business, and we are working overtime. We have had to extend our premises to more than twice their former size within the past 2 months. Irish industry has definitely appreciated and not depreciated since the war," they said.
The Kildare Observer, 9th January 1915. Mr. F.V. de Vere, Honourable Secretary of the County Kildare Belgian Refugees Committee, has received the following letter from the Local Government Board. "With reference to previous correspondence on the subject of hospitality for Belgian refugees, I am to inform you that as a steady flow of refugees into this country appears to have now commenced, the Local Government Board will be glad to receive as many offers of complete hospitality from County Kildare as possible."
Today, the health risks of smoking are well known, but for one soldier named Arthur Haid, the habit saved his life. His battered old cigarette box is marked by bullets. Without that metal box in his pocket, he may well have been killed at a battle in France in 1914. Arthur's good fortune is inscribed on the box. It reads, "This box saved my life at the Battle of Neuve-Chapelle, October 26, 1914. His luck lasted throughout the rest of the war. After spending some time at a POW camp, he returned home safely."
Private John Gahan of the 2nd Irish Guards entered the French theatre of war on the 21st of November 1915. Over 2.5 years later, it would be the great German spring offensive of 1918 that ended his life, killed in action at Ayette on the 27th of March. Today, he is among the 35,000 servicemen with no known graves commemorated on the Arras Memorial. One of the only belongings that did make it home was the identity disc he was wearing when he died. Sent home to comfort his family, perhaps all they had of their loved one, it is perfunctory. 8610 J. Gahan, Roman Catholic, Irish Guards.
"Dear Mrs. Kettle, I've read this morning with deep regret in the Times that my old school fellow and fellow student, Lieutenant Kettle, has been killed in action. I hope you will not deem it a stranger's intrusion on your grief to accept from me a word of sincere condolence. I remember very gratefully his benevolent and courteous friendliness to me when I was in Ireland 7 years ago. May I ask you also to convey to your sisters, whose addresses I do not know, my sympathy with them in the losses they have suffered. I am grieved to learn that so many misfortunes have fallen on your family in these evil days. James Joyce, 25th of September, 1916.
Harold Sloane was killed in action on the Western Front in January 1917, aged 34. He was the most outstanding player of his generation in the Bohemians football team, and his name is closely linked with the team's home ground, Dalymount Park. In his international career, his greatest achievement was a hat-trick in a 4-4 draw with Wales at Cardiff Arms Park in 1906. A century on, his total of 8 caps has never been bettered by another Bohemian player. Lieutenant Sloane was survived by his widow Maple and is buried at the Guards Cemetery in Comble, France.
For the 2nd Royal Dublin Fusiliers, the war came to a close as part of the 149th Infantry Brigade. One of their men brought home what to him must have been the most important telegram he had seen after 4 long years of war. It read as follows: "Hostilities will cease at 11 hours today, November 11th, 1918. Defensive precautions will be maintained. There will be no intercourse of any description with the enemy until receipt of further instructions. 50th Division, 08:30 hours.
During the First World War, there was intense inflation on a lot of products, including food products. And so these are a few of the food prices that went up from 1914 to 1918. A ton of flour in 1914 costs £9.08.6. In 1918, it costs £17.14. A cubic weight of beef in 1914 costs £2.11.4. In 1918, it costs £6.02.6. A cubic weight of sugar in 1914 costs £14.03. By 1918, it costs £3.05.5. A cubic weight of butter in 1914 cost £5.03. In 1918, it cost £12.16.
Discipline in the British Army was very rigid for soldiers, and they could be executed for transgressions in the field. The Irish soldiers in the British Army experienced this when 28 of them were executed over the war between 1915 and 1918. Many of them were suffering the pressures of fighting in a modern war, something that we would now call post-traumatic stress disorder. And this caused them to leave their posts or to go AWOL from the army and later on be captured. After a very simple summary court-martial, they were executed in the field. Often these executions were carried out to make an example to the other troops to make sure that they did not go and leave their posts.
Troops on opposite sides of No Man's Land often knew where the men they were facing came from. When the Germans at the front heard about the 1916 rising, they hoped to demoralise the Irish opposite. The War Diary of the 8th Royal Munster Fusiliers for 10th of May 1916 records one such effort. It reads, "Lieutenant Biggin went out to enemy sap. It was unoccupied. He brought back two notice boards put up by the Germans with the following announcements. Irishmen, heavy uproar in Ireland. English guns are firing at your wives and children. 1st of May 1916. And interesting war news of April 29th, 1916. Cut de la Mara has been taken by the Turks, and whole English army therein, 13,000 men, make prisoners."
rte.ie/worldwar1